let me get this straight. If the indictment is... if the indictment is, and I have seen you say this, that crossfire reduces everything, as I said in the intro, to left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left.
Stop.
Why do we have to fight?
Why do you argue?
We're in bad shape, fellas.
We need help from the media, and they're hurting us. You're doing theater when you should be doing debate.
You're listening to Under Surveillance, WLEW's biweekly show on popular culture, politics, and the relationship between mass media and public opinion. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and every second and fourth Wednesday mornings, I'll be joined by a series of guests as we take a look at everything from the makeup of the Supreme Court to upcoming elections and to how social and political climates impact our view of the future in film and television. Under Surveillance is broadcast on WLEW, a listener-supported community radio. And for more information or to listen to archive shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. Today on Under Surveillance, we'll look at the intersection of music and culture. How does our cultural background influence our musical preferences? How does the way in which people form musical tastes differ from that of other forms of artistic expression? And how has the advent of television changed the way in which we process music? My guest is John Shepherd, a professor of music and sociology at Carleton University. That's up next on Under Surveillance. This is WLEW, listener-supported community radio, and you're listening to Under Surveillance. My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm happy to be joined today by John Shepherd, who is a professor of music and sociology at Carleton University. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you.
Today on the program, we're going to be discussing all sorts of topics revolving around the intersection of music and culture. Everything from why we like the music we do to the impact of television on mass musical preferences. So, John, how do we form our own individual tastes for different genres of music?
It's a very simple question that doesn't really have a straightforward answer. I mean, there are a huge number of influences starting right from childhood. Obviously, contact with other children, the music that's played in a home will have a very marked effect, particularly as children reach the sort of teenage years and peer groups really begin to become a factor, of course, then. The influence of the peer group is huge. But I would also say that it's not only outside influences, I think it's also how we grow up as people. So the way we form our musical tastes has to do not only with the music that we're exposed to and the music that we feel we should identify with because it's the music that's subscribed to by people who are important in our lives, like our parents and our siblings and our peer group and so on. It also has to do with how we're developing as individuals more widely. And in fact, my own belief is that the musical taste that we develop as we grow up has a lot to do with how we develop our individual identity as a person in relationship to all the other people that we're in contact with, and especially importantly in today's world, the media outlets to which we're exposed on a daily basis, which are clearly ubiquitous. So that's a kind of general answer, and we could sort of follow up on parts of it.
Oh, yeah, we have many sub-questions branching off of this query. Let's start with, you mentioned the impact of the home and the impact of parents. And, you know, on one hand, you think kids would be predisposed to liking music that's played to them consistently at an early age.
Mm-hmm.
But then later on, there's that switch that's triggered where any music preferred by their parents is hopelessly uncool.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the most wonderful things that happens, of course, is that particularly teenage kids develop musical tastes that many of their parents can't even identify as music. In fact, you know, the word that's often used is noise, you know, turn off that awful noise, which is an interesting comment to which we can refer. But I think what happens as people get older, and particularly as they move into their 20s and 30s and 40s, is that those earlier exposures can slowly resurface. So it's important, I think, to understand that our musical tastes through life are definitely not fixed, although some will last, and that the range of musical tastes that we have, that range and the kinds of music that make up that range develop and change organically as we go through life. I mean, what's particularly interesting at the moment, I found interesting, is the way in which a musical style that isn't quite the same as the music of the big band era but really draws on it has actually sort of come back into the top 40. I mean, that's interesting, and I think that has to do with demographic forces, particularly the generation of the baby boomers.
How do you think that the process of developing musical tastes is different than that of, say, film or literature?
It's hugely different. I mean, the easiest contrast to draw is with that of literature, because clearly that involves, on the whole, a kind of silent and visual exchange between you and the written page. What I think is not terribly well understood about music is that it works by the sounds of music actually having a very direct and material effect, and indeed affect, upon our bodies. So the example I always use when I'm trying to get this point across in classes is that when we hear somebody scream, and it's a real situation, I mean, somebody is terrified, something happens in our bodies. What happens is that we experience, not to the same extent, but nonetheless we experience the same kind of bodily experience that they do, because our bodies instantly recognize the configuration that their bodies have to go into to utter that scream, and our bodies respond to that scream by doing that to a lesser extent. So, for example, I'm a flute player, so when I listen to a flute being performed, I can feel instantaneously what's going on inside that person's body in relationship to the sound that they're producing, particularly if they're having a little bit of trouble, you know, as most instrumentalists do from time to time. I mean, certain passages are a challenge, or, you know, the breathing may be difficult with very high passages and so on, or the embouchure may be strained. I know that instantaneously from the quality of the sound. So the kind of interaction we have with music is powerfully intimate and personal, much more so than it is with literature. Film is interesting because film, of course, uses a wide range of channels. There's the narrative, there's the visual, and of course there's the soundtrack, in which music figures very, very importantly. And in fact, one of the interesting things about the field of film studies over the last 10 to 15 years is that film studies, which in most places has grown out of English literature departments, has begun to come to terms with the fact that a very important part of films is indeed the soundtrack. I mean, that's how the affective track of the narrative, if you like, is managed. And if you took the soundtrack away from films, particularly the musical part, in fact, the film would make much less of an impact. So the way that we respond to music, in fact, underwrites a very important part of how we relate to film. But it's not quite as intimate and personal because, of course, there are all the other more public sort of channels of communication with film. But it's very important to understand the way in which music works, because it also, I think, affects that process of organic change that we go through in our lives in terms of the range of musics that we identify with.
Yeah, there's that emotional connection in music that you don't have with literature. And with film, you have more distractions, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we have to be very careful that there is an emotional attachment with literature. But the way I often put it is that with literature, the first appeal is to our heads, if you like, and that transfers to our bodies, whereas with music is the other way around. The sort of, there's always a gut response with music, which then we may try and sort of rationalize afterwards, sort of mentally and cerebrally. So all those sort of parts of a response to a work of art or culture, no matter what the medium, whether it's film or literature or you're in an art gallery or music, all those different aspects are there. But they're sort of prioritized in different ways, and they have different roots, so that with literature, the channel is undoubtedly visual and cerebral, and then comes the affective response, whereas with music, there's a gut response, and then afterwards we may try and think about it and rationalize it. And that's why, in fact, the response to music tends to be more, if I can put it this way, more emotional and less considered. So, I mean, that indeed is why parents tell kids to turn that wretched noise off, because their bodies can't literally get into it as something that they really recognize as music. I mean, another beautiful example of that is the riots in Paris, I think in 1913, when Stravinsky's Rite of Spring was first performed. And the riot occurred because people were incensed that what they had heard was put over to them as music. And what was happening, in fact, was that they had no basis in terms of which to literally get into the sounds of the music.
Do you think that people's tastes in music tend to fossilize more than that of other forms of art? For instance, many people won't read the same books or watch the same kinds of films that they did when they were younger, but after a certain point, many people do stop listening to new bands, to new music.
Yeah, I think that's basically correct, and for the reasons I think that I've just laid out. Again, one has to be very careful. I mean, there will be some threads that will last almost a lifetime and others that will come in and out. But, I mean, I recently went to an Eric Clapton concert in Ottawa, which was absolutely fantastic. I mean, he hasn't lost anything. But it was interesting that the median age of the audience was probably over 50. So, I mean, that tells you something, that there's a group of people for whom Eric Clapton has been an absolute constant. I mean, there are other obvious examples. I mean, the Rolling Stones, for example, who are still pulling large audiences, and other performers who are sort of getting advanced in years, such as Elton John and Rod Stewart and so on, whose fan base was built probably back in the 1970s and are still drawing huge audiences. Elton John's coming to do a concert in Ottawa very soon, and the auditorium or the hockey rink in which he performs holds for a concert about 16,000 people, and I think it was sold out in like 90 minutes, which when you stop to think about it is incredible, because the fan base was probably built in its basic components something like, 30 years ago.
Do you think that there still be artists equivalent to Elton John, to the Stones, to U2, playing those large shows 20 years from now, today's artists, will mass collective appeal for musical artists still exist in the future?
I think it's likely, yes. I mean, it's always very dangerous to sort of predict these things because the world is constantly changing. But yes, I mean, if I had to sort of make a guess, I would say that that's likely to persist. I think that obviously the sort of teenage years and the years in the early 20s are sort of highly formative in terms of the people we become as adults, and I think there's little doubt that music for most people during that period is a major formative influence on who they become, and I think therefore it's more than likely that those kinds of influences will last. I mean, I find what's going on at the moment with people like Elton John and Rod Stewart and you know other people really interesting, because when I was sort of at that teenage stage in the 60s, there was a real sort of cleavage between that music and anything that had been performed probably before about the mid-1950s, before early rock and roll. So if you went back 20 years from, let's say, 1967-68, which were sort of quite important years in the history of popular music, to, let's say, 47 or 48, you were at the end of the big band era. And in fact, you know, that music just wasn't cutting it at all in terms of popularity in the 60s. So, I mean, I think that it does happen. For example, my father-in-law, his attachment is still very much to that period in the 40s because of when he was born, sort of around about 1920. But again, you have to take into account the demographics. I think a major demographic in the development of the music industry over the last probably 40 years has been that baby boomer generation when there was a real bulge. And so that market power has lasted over 40 years. So again, I think that's a factor in what we're experiencing now with, you know, rockers like Jagger who are over 60 and forming. So it's always a bit complicated, but I would be surprised if some music that sort of kids are listening to now, some of that didn't persist for quite a long time for their generation.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm happy to be joined today by John Shepherd, who is a professor of music and sociology at Carleton University. And today we're discussing all sorts of topics revolving around the intersection of music and culture. And earlier you mentioned the demographics at the Eric Clapton concert that you went to, where you said that there probably weren't many people younger than 40 in the audience.
Right. The real guitar specialists, right?
Yeah. There was a great essay that Chuck Klosterman wrote a few years ago for Spin magazine about how the majority of fans at a Smiths convention in Los Angeles were Latino teenagers, and he couldn't figure out why Morrissey would appeal so strongly to this particular demographic. And when I go to rock shows, it's extremely rare to see minorities in the audience.
Right.
Why is this the case?
Well, I think it has to do with cultural identity. I mean, there is the complexity of the musical taste that we develop and which change with us as we go through our lives, but that's underwritten also still, I think, by pretty powerful cultural allegiances. So, particularly if we identify very strongly with a particular ethnic group, then clearly who we are as a person is shaped to a large degree by the character of that ethnicity and a very important formative influence. And if you like, reflector of that ethnic identity will be the music that's produced either by or for that particular ethnic group. And, I mean, it's interesting that there are some very deep-seated things going on here to do with, say, intonation of language of ethnic groups, which tends to transfer into music. I mean, I have a very strong feeling, although I've never been able to sort of do the research to substantiate this, that particular ethnic cultures do have rhythms, and this affects the way that people walk, it affects the way that they use their hands when they're gesticulating, and that sort of moves to and fro in terms of language and music. So again, there's this very powerful sort of affective glue going on, if you like, that really affects the way that people identify with particular forms of music. And of course, one of the most important things that goes on when people are identifying with the culture is that they identify the culture in terms of it not being other cultures, which therefore is why you don't find a lot of minority groups, if you like, at rock concerts, because maybe they define themselves against that music because that music is associated with with other cultures in terms of which they define themselves.
Well, I think the interesting contrast, though, is that you will see a lot of white people, though, at shows that feature minority artists. You know, I'm assuming most of the crowd at a Prince show would be white. And in a lot of hip-hop shows, you know, Public Enemy used to draw a great number of white fans at their shows. So you do see it happen the other way around.
It happened the other way around. And, of course, one of the very complex things that we're trying to understand is the relationship between the local and the global in the world in which we live, because one of the things that's clearly happened over the last 30 and 40 years, and this has accelerated dramatically over the last 15 to 20 years, is the ease and the speed with which cultural artifacts, and particularly music, can be sped around the world. So that while a person may identify with a particular ethnic culture, and that may well be what we might want to identify in North America, let's say, as just sort of generally mainstream white North American culture, they will also have very easy access to a whole range of other musics with which, for various reasons, they may feel an affinity. So, I mean, one of the most interesting things is to watch how the music industry is trying to deal with this trade-off between the local and the global.
How so? How are they trying to deal with that trade-off?
I think one of the most interesting phenomena to look at in these terms at the moment is the sort of idol phenomenon, which, as you probably know, occurs not only in the United States, but in all other kinds of countries, like my own in Canada and Australia and so on. And I think one of the really interesting things that's happened is that the music industry has had to rethink how it gets audiences to attach themselves emotionally to performers and to have some kind of control over that in a world whose technology has made piracy, I think, only too easy. So what's really interesting about the idol phenomenon is the way in which at one level it's highly international, like there's no English-speaking nation that doesn't have the idol program. I mean, in Canada, we all watch with rapt attention American Idol until it finishes, and about 2 weeks after that finishes, Canadian Idol starts. So, you know, we're lucky. We get about 8 to 9 months of Idol. But it's interesting to watch how the commonalities between the American and the Canadian Idol programs, and also the differences. And what's also interesting, I think, is that what the music industry is doing is not really running a talent show. It's much more than that. What they actually do is to take young people who have a lot of raw talent that's been that's clearly there but has not been formed, if you like, by the music industry. And what happens, I think, over the 2 or 3 months that the program lasts, once they get down to the last 30 or so, is that from week to week they're actually training these young people how to become media personalities as popular singers. And because, of course, it has this competitive element to it, the audience becomes, over that period, educated to become attached to those performers, and particularly as it gets towards the end, the last 4 or 5, of course, that emotional connection becomes incredibly strong. I mean, I don't know what the figures were towards the end of American Idol last year, but the votes were in the millions. I mean, it was staggering. And it's interesting to watch that, because I think it's quite conscious strategy on the part of the music industry, given that piracy is out there, given that it's very easy for people to make and sort of record their own music, so that, you know, pushing the CD, like in stores or through advertising, or even pushing music through MTV, I think, has become a lot less effective over the last 10 to 15 years. And I think some very interesting ways in which you can sort of see the idol phenomenon as a quite consciously developed strategy on the part of the music industry to sort of counter that trend.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined today by John Shepherd, who is a professor of music and sociology at Carleton University. And today on Under Surveillance, we're talking about all sorts of questions revolving around the intersection of music and culture. And you mentioned just in this past minute or so, American Idol has taken over a role that MTV used to play. How do you view the impact of MTV today on music culture, seeing as how it's largely moved away from showcasing new bands and showing music videos?
To be honest, I haven't really followed it that much because I think it has become a lot less important. I mean, it may well remain quite important with more local musical cultures. But I think what has happened is that given the change in technology over the last 10 to 15 years, which has resulted in the same technology underwriting sort of visual communications and the communication of sound, I think the music industry has become intently more aware that when they're trying to sell a particular artist, they're not just trying to sell their music, which of course is what you get on the CD. What they have to do is to establish a very powerful affective connection between the audience and a particular phenomena. So that what's interesting is that in one sense MTV recognized this early on because, as it were, I mean, MTV and the music video has always been, if you like, part of the marketing arm of the music industry. And I think when it first came in the 80s, what it did was to market popular music just not through the sound of the music, but through channels which were as much visual as they were sonoric or sonorous or through sound. I think you can sort of watch Idol as the next step of that that becomes much more sort of complex and much more sophisticated in using the whole range of what's at play with a popular music artist, their personality, the spectacle, all the talk around them, right, which, you know, sort of goes on in the newspapers, you know, in the scandal sheets and so on. All that in a curious kind of way has become packaged into the Idol phenomenon. So you could actually view the Idol phenomenon as the next step on from MTV in that kind of development.
Well, do you think that the artists featured in Idol, though, will have staying power? Because at least with MTV, with the bands, that they were playing their own music.
Yeah.
And so they had a lot more musical credibility.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. And I think it will vary. I mean, Kelly Clarkson, who won the first American Idol, is clearly, I think, building a pretty successful career now. I mean, she's had at least three songs that have been on rotation, I think, on most sort of soft rock stations for the last few months. And I think that my sense is that career will build, and I think it will last. But I mean, I think the way to answer that is, you know, we've always had the sort of one-hit wonder. And I think it works for the music industry if some of these young people, particularly the people who make it into the last 10 or 12 or so, I mean, if they record one or two songs and that those songs return a significant profit for the music industry, then, you don't get to see the books of music industry companies, but it may well be that the bean counters in the music industry feel that sort of, the investment, whatever investment there has to be in an Idol season, has paid off in terms of the profit they turn on that particular record. And record companies have always worked that way with, you know, the one-hit wonder. So I think that's the best way to kind of think about it. I mean, I think there will be people whose careers will, you know, where the Idol program will form a platform for a career that lasts for an appreciable period of time. And there'll be those who make their one recording or their one album and it sells pretty well, but, you know, for other reasons they won't have staying power. And I think that, you know, that's always been the case in the music industry.
You mentioned before how MTV obviously changed music culture by incorporating the visual element into music. Do people exhibit different musical preferences when taking the equivalent of a blind taste test, listening to music without any particular clues as to the background of the artists?
I can't really answer that because I don't know of sort of any such test, but I would speculate that if you give somebody a blind test, as it were, I mean, you put them in a room and all they hear is the music and they don't know who the artist is and they can't recognize it, then yes, I mean, you're going to get a different response than if they experience that artist in the full context of how artists are promoted by the music industry, which certainly since the 1950s onwards has always involved visual spectacle, although initially, of course, that was the stage show. I mean, it really started, I think, with Johnny Ray and then sort of went on from there. And clearly, as you come through the 60s and into the 70s, the visual aspect is very much the sort of stage presentation. I remember that there was a wonderful example. There was a wonderful BBC television documentary on Genesis in the 70s, made by the British Broadcasting Corporation. They were doing a tour through Europe, and I think there were something like 7 or 8 tractor trailers for a band of 3 people. And the reason there were 7 or 8 tractor trailers was all the equipment they were carrying for their stage show, which at the time featured laser beams, right, which was quite new at the time. So the spectacle's always been there, but I think what you see is the way in which the spectacle is managed differently by the music industry at different points in history because of changing technology. And so if you move from the stage spectacle, which obviously is still there in concerts, it hasn't gone away, and now it's much more sophisticated than it ever was, but that sort of gets overlaid by MTV because the music industry is smart enough to realize that you can actually push songs by adding the visual channel to the sonorous channel on television. And then, of course, when the music industry is challenged by successive waves of technology, which really begin to weaken the basis of copyright in terms of generating revenue for them, you can again see another shift to using television in the form of a hugely popular show such as Idol.
On that note, I'm going to wrap it up here. My name is Kevin Fulham, and I've been joined today by John Shepherd, who's a professor of music and sociology at Carleton University. Thanks so much for your time, John, and so much for your insight.
You're very welcome.
For Professor John Shepherd, my name is Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. And for more information or to listen to archived shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. Again, that's www.undersurveillance.org.